Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of May 10th, 2015. I'm your host, Kurt Franklin, and we've got another great discussion lined up today. We're going to be talking about the top stories in IT this week, and we're glad to have you with us. We also hope that you'll be joining us for the live discussion that's taking place on InformationWeek.com. Now, if you are with us on InformationWeek.com live, all you have to do to add your voice to the discussion is to type your comment or question into the box helpfully labeled your post, then be sure to hit that big red post button under the box. Now, we'll be joining in that conversation in just a little while, but between now and then, I've got two of my colleagues who are going to be, well, talking about the week that was in IT news. My colleagues are Chris Murphy, who is editor of Information Week. Chris, welcome.
Thank you, Kurt.
And Dave Wagner, who is executive editor for Community and IT Life here at Information Week. Dave, welcome to Information Week Radio.
Thanks, Kurt.
So I've got to ask, and what really caught your eye this week? I mean, there are a bunch of sort of interesting stories, nothing that struck me as absolutely earth-shattering, but lots of news going on. Dave, I'm curious, what caught your attention?
Well, I have to say what caught my attention was all the things going on with Google's self-driving car. We heard that they got into accidents this week, which was very interesting. And we heard that their newest version, which is no longer a modified car, but their own built car, is going to start testing this summer. I found both of those pieces of data very interesting.
All right. Probably going to come back to that in a minute because I think there are some interesting aspects. Chris, how about you? What really caught your fancy this week?
Well, I was looking at an article that Tom Claiborne wrote that talked about the obstacles to the Internet of Things. It relates to what Dave was just talking about with the Google self-driving car, which is a thing, to be sure. Really detailing six obstacles to the Internet of Things, and I think that as we see what I think is inevitable in terms of the progress towards more connected devices, that was really good to look at the details of it.
That is interesting, those obstacles. And interestingly enough, it kind of ties into one of the things that I had on my mind. And it was something that really sort of came out of my time at SAP's Sapphire a couple of weeks ago. When SAP was talking about the Internet of Things, what they're doing with it, and what one of their partners is doing with it, and it struck me that the way that SAP is defining the Internet of Things is fundamentally different than the way a lot of people define it when they're talking about it, because it's very easy, it seems, to get wrapped up in all of the consumer angles to the Internet of Things. You know, this everything from the wearables, the watches and the sensors that go on, to things that control the temperature in your house. But they're really talking about it from an industrial standpoint. For them, the Internet of Things is all about the machines that live on assembly lines or the kind of equipment that maintains the climate in large office parks, or, Dave, to get back to your point, vehicles that drive themselves autonomously. And my question to each of you is it time for us to start making a differentiation in our language between this consumer Internet of Things and the industrial Internet of Things?
I would say no. Don't worry about it. Don't make this hard. The Internet of Things, not hard. hard to execute, but not hard in concept. Do you want a sensor or some sort of connection to a device that's moving about or stationary, you're moving about and you want to get information off it? If you want to get information off that in some way, whatever that is, that's the Internet of Things. Is that information valuable? Can you do something useful with it? That's a useful Internet of Things. So it might be in the consumer world. There's a ton of industrial examples of it, but let's not make it hard. Internet of Things is exactly what it is. It's not oversold in what it is. It just doesn't make sense for everything. I don't need a connected treehouse, but or swing set, but there's tons of useful examples in the industrial world. There are going to be tons of them in the consumer world.
Okay, first of all, I totally need a connected treehouse. I'm building one.
I knew as soon as I said
right
that you were going to want an Internet of treehouses.
But more importantly, I agree with you for the moment, Chris. Keep it simple. I think there's a day, though, where that changing of language might be useful, but not yet. I think really, realistically, the only real success we're having with the Internet of Things right now is industrial. It is behind the scenes in manufacturing and in the enterprise. I think we're really only having a tiny, tiny handful of consumer success in IoT. I think we're doing much, much better on the industrial side, the facility side, manufacturing side. So I think right now we need that term so that we can say, okay, consumer product makers, look at these examples and see what you can do and how you can do it. I think there's going to be a day, however, when we're going to stop thinking about what we're doing with industrial Internet of Things as the same thing that we're doing with consumer Internet of Things. I think for the most part, we're going to see Internet of Things pretty mature in the manufacturing sector pretty darn fast. We're going to put sensors on everything, and when we're done putting sensors on everything, we're going to basically be done. That's it. But the Internet of Things from a consumer side is going to go far beyond sensors. It's going to go into products and services in ways that we may not even be able to imagine today. And once we start talking about it from that point of view, I think it's going to take off to be something else. But right now, we're not there.
Well, it seemed to me that one of the things, you know, we're talking so much about the sensors, but one of the things that I heard about from SAP and, you know, to be honest, from their industrial partners was the idea of using these sensors to issue commands. They kept talking about things like predictive maintenance. In other words, figuring out from a lot of different sources when a product or a component in a system is likely to start going bad and replace it before it does. And they talked about doing things like sending autonomous vehicles with parts so that they could, you know, meet a service person on site somewhere. What do you think about that? I mean, we're talking about the autonomous vehicles, and they've started to get into crashes, as was inevitable. We've got the autonomous 18-wheeler rolling about in Nevada. You know, are we getting close? Do you think we will get closer first with autonomous vehicles that deliver things than vehicles that deliver people? Now, that's another interesting question, I think.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely certain that we're going to get that the real test bed for autonomous vehicles isn't the highway, though that's important. It's actually going to be in a complicated industrial or construction site where there are people milling about, so that it's an uncontrolled environment. But it is not a place where if the car makes a mistake, it hits a bus and kills 35 school kids or something like that. We're going to see you know, trucks and construction vehicles and things first. We're going to show that it works, and then a couple years later, we're going to do more on the highway than we're doing. We have to keep testing on the highway because it's a different set of problems. But the first place we're going to see real success is going to be in slightly more controlled environments.
Chris, what do you think about that? You think that we're heading down the autonomous vehicles in industrial scenarios before we get them on the roads? And I think it's worth saying that we've already got that. I have seen what amount to autonomous mine trucks, the huge dump trucks that that carry, you know, ore from the bottom of a mine up to a processing plant. I have seen those be automated for some time, so it may well be that we're a generation ahead in that kind of environment.
Right. I don't know those environments well enough to really know what on construction sites. I know there's a lot of automation that they're looking at and a lot of connected device monitoring that they're doing, starting to do in those kind of sites, because as you describe, that notion of preventative maintenance and not having unplanned downtime is one of the just really clear ROI opportunities out there that companies are really good at calculating. They can tell you exactly how much it will cost them to have a mine not operating for 15 minutes. And so they can very easily calculate what it would be worth, what it would be worth investing in. That's the kind of thing that businesses do all day long. And the ROI on those preventing unplanned downtime is really clear.
Well, on that preventing the downtime, one of the components to that as well is tied up in big data, you know, bringing a lot of different things together and collecting the data, processing it, doing stuff with it. And I saw that we had a couple of articles this week about Hadoop and its growth, which is kind of slow and steady, as befits the little cartoon elephant that is Hadoop's mascot. The fact that it's not just exploding in terms of the market, do you think that what the market is telling us is that big data has been oversold? Or do you think this is a Hadoop issue and not a big data issue? I mean, what do you think about the prospects for big data as a whole?
I mean, if you think of big data as combining data from multiple sources and getting more value out of it, the direction on that's pretty clear. I think we have an insatiable appetite for that. And then it's just a matter of being able to get the value out of it, and that's hard work. That's still hard work. It's not a plug it in and make it go kind of proposition. So I think it just shows that it's still hard work. Says less about the potential for it than the, you know what, technology is still hard. Technology at this scale is still hard work, and there's it's not something they can just plug in and add more data to, and it cooks up to insight.
Right, and connected to it being hard is that now we're starting to see analytics as a service and big data as a service from IBM and Microsoft and others, SaaS. And what I think is happening is some people are saying, wow, this is hard. Let's pay for somebody to do the heavy lifting of the technology, because we don't need to run a Hadoop stack. What we really need is the data after it's crunched. So it makes sense to me that a lot of mid-sized companies and smaller are going to not ever adopt Hadoop themselves, but they're going to pay somebody who's running Hadoop or their own secret sauce, whatever it is, to say, here's your data. This is what you wanted out of it. Here it is. And so Hadoop may be just a luxury that not everybody can afford to invest in, but data is not.
or even know they're using, right, Dave? I don't know what gave me this outcome, but here's what I got.
Right, exactly. I think basically Hadoop is just going to run in the background, however it's done, right? Whether it's the people you're paying to run Hadoop for you or not, it's what they want. What they want is the end result, and Hadoop is about creating, you know, the result. And I think we're just paying more people to get us to that point. And that makes sense to me. I don't have any problem with that, really. You know, not everybody's Facebook or Google that needs to churn through petabytes of data in seconds. So why invest like we are?
Well, now, in terms of that investment, I think it's fascinating that sort of Hadoop has been the face of big data, but we really are starting to get a lot more players in there. You know, we talked about IBM, Microsoft would certainly like to play in that that field, and in terms of the services, I mean, Amazon with AWS would be happy to be your host for anything and everything big data. Do you think in terms of the difficulty, though? I know, Chris, you talked about the technology being hard. When you're saying that, do you mean that the nuts and bolts of keeping Hadoop running, keeping that Hadoop cluster available is hard, or do you see the hard part still being figuring out how to do something with the data to make it meaningful? I've heard over the past month or two a lot of people talking about figuring out how to tell the story around data. Do you think that's the hard part?
Well, I think I'm no expert on Hadoop implementation. I just know from conversation, people talk about, well, there's a certain skill you have to bring in, and there's some different approaches you need to take. But I think, as is always the case, when we bring in new technology, it's the, you know, what do you do with the insight? And I think a lot of companies are wrestling with questions. Like, we were at the Information Week conference last month, and a lot of people were asking questions in some of our analytics sessions about the ownership of the data, for example. So some of these approaches, big data approaches, one of the key factors here is we're bringing data together from multiple sources. That's the new part of big data, is we're bringing data together from multiple places within the company, sometimes outside, but even within the company, there's this, who owns the data? Who controls the data? Who gives the okay to share the data? They talked at length in a session with ConocoPhillips, where they're doing some real breakthrough analytics work about how they're working to make sure that everybody is comfortable with sharing data across business units. But that's just an example of the kind of organizational and business challenges people are wrestling with big data. Geez, can everybody within the company see this chunk of data? Well, yeah, if we're going to make sense of it and find insights that we've never had before, that's exactly what we need.
Dave, what do you think? I mean, when you look at what's going on in and around all of the data in the Internet of Things, do you see the technology being the hard part, or figuring out how to tell the story being the hard part? I mean, essentially, do we still need to figure out how to analyze things before we can figure out the best technology to use?
Right. Well, I think in a lot of ways, it's really about where you want to put your money, right? If all you wanted to do on a roulette table was make sure you won something, you'd put some money in red, some money on black, and some money on the green zeros, right? That takes a lot of money to do it, and you don't actually win a lot in the process, right? But to make good with data, you have to pay for the actual infrastructure of the Hadoop stack itself. You have to pay to bring in the people who are going to run that stack. And most importantly, you have to transform your management team, your analysts inside your organization to be data-driven, trained to how to deal with data, excited about data, happy about data, willing to do it. That's a lot of money, a lot of time. there, I think that there are a lot of companies who are saying, we don't have the money to do it all, or we don't have the money to do it all well, but we do have the money to do to hire managers that know how to work with data and then pay people to do our data for us. Or we do have the money to put our data in the cloud and work with it from there, something like that. So I don't think any of it is less hard or harder. I think it's all just really expensive, and it's about transforming an organization from the ground up. And it makes sense to me that I would start with transforming my leadership to be more data-driven before I invested millions in a Hadoop stack that would provide me this data, and then I wouldn't have any managers that would use it right anyway.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned the expense, because one of the things that we keep hearing about after the SAP HANA platform came along, which is all in-memory, now we're starting to get a number of in-memory solutions for figuring out the analytics part of databases. I mean, we know that Microsoft is working on one, Oracle, HP. There are a bunch of different companies that have this in-memory technology that they're working on at various stages. The thing that I found fascinating, I saw an example of what an Intel-based computer system would be if you wanted to keep, let's call it 170 terabytes in memory. And the number was north of $20 million. And I find it fascinating, that it's possible to spend $20 million+ on what is essentially a giant PC. And second, that this is still considered to be an economical way to do things by some companies out there, the companies that truly, truly need this analysis right now. Because with the in-memory, of course, they can get answers. The example they gave was if you're just searching back over the last month or so, you can ask any question based on the data and get an answer back within a second. And that's the kind of response that you've got to have if you're going to do all of this, you know, autonomous vehicleizing and stuff. If you're going to be making decisions off of the data, you better get the response back real quickly rather than having to wait, you know, 3 days for a batch job before you know whether to apply the brakes given what's in front of you.
Right. Well, and the $20 million isn't the end of the expense, right? They're the people who need to understand how to keep it running, how to make it work with your organization and not just as a piece of equipment. So we're talking about an extremely expensive thing, but we're also talking about something that's getting cheaper, you know, believe it or not. So I mean, think about it, not only from the point of view of the expense of the computer, but from the ability to do it at all, right? The same concept would have not only cost more in time, it would have cost more in money. So that's great. It's coming down. But in reality, I think you're still talking about a technology that is only required to be owned by a very small number of organizations, to be rented and leased by more, I think.
Well, we've been talking about the Internet of Things and big data, and we're now joined by another of our colleagues. Kelly Sheridan has dialed in. Kelly, welcome to Information Week Live.
Hi there, Kurt. Sorry I'm late.
Oh, that's okay. We've been warming up the discussion, talking about the Internet of Things and big data. Now, I'm curious, you spend a lot of time around the world of Microsoft and some of the other big enterprise software companies. Are you seeing any real movement in terms of either big data or the integration of the Internet of Things into what Microsoft or their competition is doing?
Well, Microsoft in particular had a lot to say about big data during their Ignite conference, which was a couple of weeks ago. They had a lot of announcements pertaining to their SQL Server 2016, their Azure Stack, the Operations Management Suite. So all of these things are, especially the SQL Server, are intended to better protect data and let people bring different kinds of data into Azure and improve memory. And so that I would say that, yes, long story short, big data is definitely a focus for them.
Well, do you think that while it's a focus, where do you think they are? I mean, is it just that they have said that it's a focus, or are there really products out there that customers, either enterprise or medium-sized businesses, can use to begin to make sense of big data and the Internet of Things and tie it into their Microsoft-based data infrastructure?
Kind of an in-between. All of these things that they have announced are more than ideas, but they're not yet completely available. A lot of these things that they have announced are in development. For example, the SQL Server 2016 will be available in preview later this summer. So it's something that they're currently working on, but we're not going to be able to see or try it for another few months or so. And they also announced that over the next year, they'll be continuing to make updates to their various services and platforms. So while it's an ongoing process, really.
Well, it's interesting to me. One of the things that seems to have calmed down a bit of late is the discussion of privacy and security around the Internet of Things and big data. I mean, a year ago, when people talked about big data, it was all about how companies were going to be able to put together information about your innermost secrets based upon your thermostat setting and your Twitter hashtags and, you know, something else, the brand of dog food you bought. But I haven't heard a lot about that lately. Do you think that people have just stopped caring about that, or has the discussion simply moved on for the time being and we're going to revisit the privacy issue in the future? What do you think?
I think it'll dominate the discussion. It'll never go away. It's one of the, and that list of six obstacles to the Internet of Things by McKinsey that Tom Claiborne wrote about, number one was security and privacy. And Tom makes a good point that they're two different things. The security piece of, is this data protected? And the privacy piece of, hey, it might be good for you, but is it good for me? And that notion of whether you want to share the data, whether there's any in it, is there really anything in it for me as the customer for you to have that data? And I think that discussion will continue. I think it'll get continue to be a tension point, and with some embarrassing disclosures when customers find out that, wait, that piece of data is coming back too. So I think it's not tempered at all.
I just don't think consumers know. I don't think they've made it a point to learn how they're being violated, and I don't think they really care all that much. I mean, obviously there are exceptions, and those exceptions are noisy enough that sometimes they wake other people up to what's happening. But I just don't think most Americans care that much as long as they get something out of the product. They have to get something out of it. I mean, we've known that for years. You have to. It's no different than a customer loyalty card, right? I'll fill out a customer loyalty card to any company that I trust and gives me the right kind of points that I want for the others. I think security is a much, much bigger issue, and I think Tom is right that it's a different thing. I think you're opening so many new vectors of attack. Every time you it's a thermostat next, and then it's a pump, and then it's a filter, and then whatever it is, everything that you put a new entry point, a new networked connection on, is a new vector of attack. And I think that is significantly a bigger deal than privacy.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned people not understanding and consumers not understanding. And, I think we also get into the attention span of the consumer. You know, a story comes along that breaks their attention span from the privacy issue, and they go on to something else, which is, I must say, an artful segue into this week's Geekend, which is all about the fact that our attention spans may not be nearly as impressive as we think they are. Dave, something's fishy with our attention spans here.
I'm sorry, Kurt, I wasn't paying attention. What was your question?
Talking about the Geekend.
The funny thing about the report that Microsoft Canada came out with a couple days ago turns out to be a statistic that they didn't even create. They just quoted, but it's been the headline everybody's been using to cover it, which is that since the year 2000 to the year 2013, our attention span dropped 25%. And that means that we now have a lower attention span than a goldfish. And I think that means an awful lot to people, because I think we've all been trained on that concept that the goldfish, you know, every time they see the little plastic castle, it's a surprise. We are not capable of concentrating as well as a goldfish anymore. Interestingly enough, though, the real takeaway from Microsoft Canada's report is not that it is our attention span is dropping. It's that this is a good thing. What Microsoft Canada says is that our attention span dropping is a natural adaptation to a faster-moving world. And that actually, despite the fact that we only pay attention in tiny bursts, these tiny bursts are actually far, far, far more efficient than sitting down and concentrating on one thing. So, for example, they followed a person who just watched a TV show and did nothing else, and they followed a person who watched a TV show while also playing with their phone. And the person who was playing with their phone on social media while also watching TV retained information better, concentrated on both better, and were more engaged. And that's because when we start to task switch, our brain comes up with tiny bursts of very serious attention. So when that same person who's only watching one TV show, they pay attention and then they drift off, and that's it, and they don't come back very easily. When somebody is task switching, they continue and more efficiently go back and forth between bursts of attention. And the reason is our brain is trained, because of our hunting and gathering days, to follow moving targets. And the world is just one great moving target at a time. And so it's extremely fascinating, because I think a lot of people think that we're making ourselves dumber or less capable of memorizing things and just less good because of our multitasking world. And Microsoft is saying, no, it's the opposite.
Very, very interesting. It sounds like I owe my son an apology, because I was always on him when he was in high school to concentrate on one thing rather than being all, in his father's words, scattered. But it sounds like he was actually employing a very successful information retention strategy.
Yes, it's an evolutionary strategy. It really is. Now, this is a bell curve. Like everything else, there are people who do it poorly and people who do it well. So you need to understand your own skill set. And you need to understand that there are moments where you need to focus. you know, for long periods of time on one thing. That there are exceptions, but for the most part, we're actually doing exactly what we should be doing to adapt to a modern world.
Chris, I've got to ask you, what do you think? Are you in the concentrate in your goldfish-like bursts, or are you all into the multitasking and task switching as quickly as possible?
Kurt, I would say I'm in the camp of parents are right and teenagers are wrong, and I will not allow you to backtrack in any way on your advice to your teenager. You were right, and the teenager was wrong. We have to establish that as policy. So I think it's very much task dependent. You know, there are things that, for me in my world, require concentrated, complete concentration, and things that don't. And so, if I'm going to write an article, I write better if I'm concentrating and not going back and forth. Otherwise, it takes me a lot longer. But some things are work just fine in goldfish mode.
So Kelly, I have to turn to you. How many things do you usually have going on at any one time?
Like 10. I'm a goldfish.
Go Kelly.
I don't know, it's
weird because when I heard, Dave, I think you made some great points. When you originally said, or when you originally introduced the idea that you're going to explore this study, I thought, oh, this means we're getting dumber. But when you explain, like, oh, well, this basically means that you're just directing your attention in shorter bursts to different things over the same period of time, I thought, I do that frequently, and I've never really considered myself as having the attention span of a goldfish, but maybe that's something I need to get used to.
Means you're highly evolved.
But in all seriousness, I find it, if I work on something for like 15, 20 minutes and then switch to a different task, I find that I can focus more on both of those things, even though I'm spending less time on each in a certain time period. It's strange.
Right. Well, I can attest, I've seen Kelly at her desk, and she has several devices open at any given moment. So she's definitely telling the truth. What's interesting is that we front load our attention spans. So one of the things you'll note is that there's a point of diminishing returns on paying attention. I actually noticed this in a very funny way. I started posting some YouTube videos as part of the article just for fun to say, you know, here's a distraction, so you come back and finish the article. And I noticed my attention span is supposedly 8 seconds, and I noticed that after about 8 seconds of watching a YouTube video, I started getting bored. And so I started, finding shorter videos. And what I noticed about doing that is that I found each one to be more engaging and more interesting. And the reason is that the dopamine hit you get from enjoying something stops. So what you're doing is you're looking for the next hit, literally like a drug. And so if I switch to another video, I get another reward. Like a dog doing tricks to get treats, right? So if I'm at work and I'm bored, the best thing I can do is not say, oh, Dave, come on, focus, focus, focus. The best thing I can do is reward myself by finding another piece of work to do and coming back. And so what I find myself doing a lot now, and I didn't notice it until reading this article, is that I'll write a paragraph of a story, and then I'll go write an email, and I'll come back and I'll write another paragraph of a story. And what I've discovered is that I've evolved my way of working to situate a new reality, exactly like Microsoft is telling me. And I had no idea I was doing it until I read it and then went, wow, that's me.
Well, it sounds like one of the key takeaways is that Vine got things exactly right with their 6-second video limit.
They did.
Well, we have had a great conversation, and I don't want to wear out the attention span of our listeners. But before we go, I do want to go around the desk and find out what's coming up for the coming week. Kelly, we'll start with you. What do you have your eyes on for the coming week?
Well, it's been a little while since we've seen a new build for Windows 10 for desktop. We got a new preview for the mobile OS just yesterday, but I'm looking forward to getting my hands on the next iteration of the desktop preview, so I'm hoping that comes out next week. So far, that's the only thing on my radar, but hey, Microsoft surprises me every single week, so we'll see what comes.
Very good. And to figure out whether that comes through, how can people keep up with you on social media?
Social media, my personal favorite is Twitter. You can find me at Kelly Sheridan. That's KellySheridan22. And I'm also on LinkedIn, first name, last name, spelled the same.
Outstanding. Well, thanks for being with us today, Kelly.
Sure thing.
Chris, how about you? You tend to take a broad view of Information Week. What's on your radar screen for the next week?
You know, we're going to bring together some of the insights that we had from our Information Week conference at the end of last month and highlight some of the CIO insights, some of the insights that might make people a little uncomfortable, kind of the uncomfort zone. Walmart CIO talked about speed and focusing not just on getting things right, but being able to recover quickly and actually measuring speed to recover, because otherwise you're constantly measuring 2, 3, 4, 5 times before you cut if you don't have the ability to recover.
Wow, recovering. It sounds like what I've been trying to do in the past few days after the various conferences I was at for the last month or so. Well, while I'm in recovery mode, how can I keep up with you on the social media? Should I look to the Twitter skies for you, or are there other places?
Yes,
I should?
Murph, at Murph, M-U-R-P-H underscore C-J.
There you go. Everyone should be following Chris Murphy. You'll be glad you did. Chris, thanks for being with us today.
Great. Thank you.
And Dave, we come to you. You always seem to be poking around the most interesting nooks and crannies of the interwebs. So what do you have coming up?
Yeah, on Sunday I have a fun thing, which is a Spotify playlist for Google Cars, since they're now going to be going on a big road trip. And next week I'll be covering NASA has a new technology roadmap that has come out. We'll be looking at that to see what it means not only for NASA but for the enterprise. And we'll also be covering euphemisms in job ads that you need to look out for if you're a job seeker.
Well, don't want to be the last person in on much of anything that you're writing about. So tell us how to keep up with what you're writing about. Where should people find you on the various social media sites?
Look for me mostly on Twitter at GeekendDave, basically like weekend, but with a G. And find me on both informationweek.com and allanalytics.com.
We will certainly do that. Dave, thanks for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, Kurt. Thank you.
And thank you for being with us for this episode of Information Week Live. We're glad you could join us. Now, if you are with us live, we appreciate it, and we hope that you're taking part in this online discussion that's been going on alongside the audio. It's been a few people in there talking. We'd love to have your voice. If you want to do that, all you have to do is type your comment into the box marked your post, and be sure to click that big red post button. Well, next week is another week of great radio programs. On Tuesday, Interop Radio is back. That's at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Then on Friday, we'll be right back here for Information Week Live at 3 p.m. Now, to keep up with all of the stuff that's going on radio, please be sure to follow me on Twitter. That's at KG4GWA. That's my Twitter handle. We'll always have the links to whatever is going on radio here at Information Week. Well, for Kelly, Chris, Dave, and all of us here at Information Week Radio, thanks so much for listening. Hey, you know, we will see you next time.